Court will now call Robert G. Rennell, D.O. versus Herschel Edward Beavers and Pamela Beavers.
May it please the court, Wade Birdwell here on behalf of Dr. Rennell, seeking relief from the trial court's refusal to grant the motion to dismiss filed by Dr. Rennell on the certain of the claims alleged by the Beavers against him with regard to a surgery that was performed in 2003 on his back. The court is very familiar with the standard of review with regard to the expert report requirement, so I won't go into that. I will only emphasize one aspect of it that the Supreme Court has made clear both in the Bowie Memorial case with regard to causation and in the recent N. Ray McAllen Medical Center case with regard to qualifications of an expert, that being that the court is not in a position to infer critical facts with regard to the particular claims that are made the subject of the expert report. And here, the trial court was asked to make such inferences and did improperly, and that is why we are before the court. There are three specific areas in which Dr. Rennell objected to the report that are before this court. One, dealing with the issue of a claim of medical battery against him on the basis of consent obtained through deception. Two, on the basis of a negligent performing of an unnecessary surgery, and three, performing the surgery negligently, specifically with regard to the padding and positioning of the patient, and thereby resulting in a rotator cuff tear in the shoulder. In all three instances, the report provided by Dr. McBride, authored by Dr. McBride, is insufficient. With regard to the battery claim, there is no mention of the battery claim whatsoever in Dr. McBride's report. He doesn't discuss the elements of such claim. He does not even discuss, which is critical to a medical battery claim, in what manner the consent was actually obtained here from Mr. Beavers. There's no discussion of the symptoms that Mr. Beavers was experiencing before the procedure, what symptoms were sought to be relieved by the procedure. There is, in fact, no discussion of the consent itself. There is no discussion and no statement that Mr. Beavers, given his circumstances with regard to whatever his symptoms were, however severe they were, however they had responded or had not responded to the particular treatment that had gone before, whether he still would have gone forward with the procedure. And absent any discussion of the circumstances of the consent, and with a simple statement that Dr. Rennell misrepresented what the radiological sequelae were with regard to the need for the surgery, that in fact what we were dealing with, what he was dealing with, was a slight bulge of the L5-S1 disc and an annular tear and some nerve root edema and disc edema, and not a blown disc, a herniated disc, that was a violation of the standard of care. Absent a discussion of battery itself, the elements of the cause of action, standard of care breach and causation have not been addressed, and therefore the report is inadequate as to that cause of action. Second, with regard to the unnecessary aspects of the surgery, much of the same argument can be made with regard to that. Ironically, within the report itself, one of the points that Dr. McBride makes to suggest that somehow this surgery should not be have gone forward on the merits of the surgery itself, i.e. with regard to what symptoms you were attempting to relieve, what the radiology did in fact show, he says that, well, the success rate with regard to alleviating leg pain when the radiological sequelae are consist of an annular tear as opposed to a herniated disc are much lower. So in other words, if you are shown to be from the radiology to be suffering from an annular tear and go forward with the procedure, your success rate in relieving the leg pain that you're attempting to relieve is much less had the radiology shown, in fact, that you had a herniated disc. Implicit in that statement, however, is in order to have any knowledge of what the comparative success rates are, you have to have patients undergoing that particular procedure and consenting to that particular procedure. And as we noted in the brief, people will consent to procedures to relieve pain, even though the success rate may be lacking somewhat. And there's no discussion in this report from Dr. McBride about any of the circumstances whatsoever with regard to those considerations having been addressed in any way, shape, or form by Dr. Rennell and considered by Mr. Beavers in giving consent. So what the court has is the court has a report that basically says that Dr. Rennell misrepresented what the actual radiology showed. Doesn't negate the fact that there was something there and that doesn't in any way, shape, or form negate the fact that Mr. Beavers was seeking some form of relief from something that was causing him significant enough pain that he had an MRI, a CT scan, a lumbar myelogram, and an EMG to try and figure out what in fact was going on with regard to his pain. But simply because there was a misrepresentation, as alleged by Dr. McBride, concerning what the radiology showed, that in and of itself rendered this an improper form of surgery, and it was utterly unnecessary, and therefore whatever consequences flowed from there, and I would point out to the court that he is utterly unspecific with regard to what actually were the consequences here. If in fact Mr. Beavers was suffering from leg pain beforehand, there is no discussion of whether or not it was relieved after the fact, or if it was exaggerated or exacerbated in any way after the fact. So from a causation standpoint, it's basically the surgery shouldn't have gone forward, and that's it. And that is legally insufficient to address each of the elements of the cause of action with regard to the healthcare liability claim predicated upon the lack of necessity of this particular procedure. Finally, with regard to the performance of the procedure that is specifically addressed in the report with regard to the rotator cuff tear, he simply states that the standard of care is to properly pad and position the patient. Dr. Rennell conceded that the rotator cuff tear occurred during this particular procedure, and therefore, it was the negligence of Dr. Rennell that approximately caused this rotator cuff tear. But there's nothing in the report to indicate. Dr. Rennell did not concede I improperly positioned or I improperly padded this particular patient for this particular procedure. There's no explanation anywhere in here that with regard to why the circumstances of the surgery would suggest that negligence is what in fact caused this particular tear. There's no discussion of whether or not this particular tear can occur in the absence of negligence. You simply are told that the standard is to properly pad and position and that the injury occurred, and you are to infer negligence from the fact of the injury itself, and that is all you are left to infer based upon this particular report. So as a result, on these three areas of this particular report, it doesn't meet the standard required to demonstrate not only the notice issue with regard to what conduct is in question. But as the Supreme Court noted in Palacios, the trial court and this court have to be able to determine the merits of the claim, the prima facie merits of the claim. You don't have to hear every expert opinion with regard to the claim, but you have to have more than a scintilla of evidence with regard to standard of care, breach, and causation, and you do not have that with this report with regard to those three particular theories of liability. And as a result, it was improper for Judge Walker to refuse to grant the motion to dismiss here. And we would argue that in each of these instances, you are dealing with a no report, an absent report, as opposed to a defective report. And most certainly you're dealing with an absent report with regard to the theory of liability of battery. And under that circumstance, this court has held in the Vaden case, we've cited in our brief and reply, pardon me a moment, the Azel Manor versus Vaden case, the court has held that distinct theories of liability, and in that particular instance, vicarious versus direct theories of liability, if in fact the author does not address direct theories of liability and offers the report a report that only substantiates the vicarious liability theories, that rendition is the appropriate relief on appeal, because the report, though it addresses the vicarious liability theories, does not in any way, shape, or form address the direct, and therefore is an absent report with regard to the direct liability theories. So here, applying that reasoning here, you would see absent a discussion of the battery elements at all, you would have an absent report as to that particular theory of liability.
What battery elements do you say should be in this report?
There, at a minimum, there has to be a discussion of the consent circumstances.
Well, wouldn't if the report shows that there was misrepresentation of a condition and needing certain type of treatment, wouldn't that get you to the non-consent? I mean, if you've been lied to, that goes to consent, doesn't it?
It does go to consent. The problem is, Your Honor, is that in the Murphy case, the Supreme Court had that just exact same allegation. That, in fact, in that particular case, the patient specifically said, I do not want to undergo general anesthesia. I want to undergo this procedure with local anesthesia. The anesthesiologist said, okay. And then when she was taken into the operating room, she was put under general. And the whole theory there, the theories alleged were battery and breach of contract and DTPA, and the Supreme Court held that in and of itself is not sufficient to establish a battery claim, that you still need, and the court pointed out at that point in time that the reason is you still need an explanation from an expert as to the circumstances dealing with the procedure itself, and gave the possibility that there might have been some type of emergency that required the procedure or the treatment that was given without consent. And so the court itself there has to be an explanation with regard to how consent was obtained, and in fact that from an expert standpoint, what the circumstances of the provision of that particular treatment were for the court to be able to address causation. But even from a straight causation standpoint here, Your Honor, there's no statement in here that Mr. Beavers would not have undergone the procedure had he been told differently than what is alleged in the report. That's part of the complaint with regard to the court. It's given no indication of what he was suffering from beforehand. There's no explanation of why he would undergo all of these different procedures to try and determine if there is some type of radiological or physiological anomaly that's causing him the pain that he's seeking relief from. And even given the lower success rate that is suggested by Dr. McBride, why a patient under his factual circumstances would not have consented to this. He doesn't even say in the report that Mr. Beavers, had he known, would not have consented to this. It's not in the report. And so you can't establish a battery claim without that kind of statement. So under these circumstances, we would ask the court for the relief requested in our prayer, that the court reverse the trial court and render as appropriate and remand as appropriate.
Okay, that was another question I had, counsel. Your prayers, render as appropriate, remand as appropriate. Would you tell me specifically what your prayer is?
The prayer is the rendition as to all three of these particular causes of action.
All three.
The court may decide that the battery is an absent report, that the rotator cuff is a deficient report, and Leland versus Brando would control the court's relief with regard to that. If the court found, however, that rendition was appropriate with regard to all three, remand would be appropriate for determination, possibly of attorney's fees. And so that's, so remand's involved in that either way, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Burwell. Ms. Wolf?
May it please the court, counsel. The trial court correctly concluded that Dr. McBride's report was sufficient for purposes of Section 74.351, state standards of care, how it was breached, and the harm that resulted. This case is unusual in two respects. First, Dr. Raynell, the appellant, gave a deposition in the underlying case in which he admitted that he was dishonest in representing to Mr. Beavers that he had a ruptured disc, and that was the reason for the need for surgery. He also admitted that the torn rotator cuff was a result of this surgery because of the positioning. With those admissions, the question of what conduct is called into question is clear from Dr. McBride's report. The case is also unusual because the appellant is not appealing the plaintiff's fraud and constructive fraud issues, but have separated out these three single issues of battery, the negligent performance of an unnecessary surgery, and the negligence with regard to the torn rotator cuff. We believe that the report is sufficient on those three issues. On the battery, granted, Dr. McBride does not use the term battery, but if you look at the Texas pattern jury charge and the way the issue is submitted, what it means is surgery without consent. It is our argument, and Dr. McBride certainly states it in his report, that the consent obtained in this case was for a particular condition and a particular procedure, a condition of a herniated disc and to fix a herniated disc. That was dishonest. It wasn't there. And so the consent that was obtained for that condition and for that surgery is non-existent. And that is a battery. We are not required to have our experts use legal terms. We're still lawyers. We can take the facts. We can take the opinions and make legal conclusions about what that means. And in this case, it means battery. With regard to the unnecessary surgery, first of all, I believe that argument was waived. The motion to dismiss contained the objections, and those were filed within 21 days, which is required by Chapter 74. If it's not filed within 21 days, it's waived. The objections don't contain an argument that this about the report omitting the unnecessary surgery claim. So I believe it was waived. It also wasn't argued in the trial court. So I believe it was waived under this court's recent decision. Of Diaz Rowena v. Melton, Walters v. Hudoba, You all have been coming out with a lot of opinions lately.
And getting a lot of these cases.
I know you are, and that's going to be my final argument. But let me finish on the unnecessary surgery and the shoulder injury. But if it wasn't presented to the trial court, and certainly if it wasn't presented in their objections within 21 days, this argument has been waived. But the report does address unnecessary surgery. I mean, he doesn't say this was unnecessary, but the essence of the report is that this was a condition that didn't exist, and a surgery for a condition that didn't exist is an unnecessary surgery. If it was a necessary surgery, why did he even lie about it? And that's our argument on that issue. With regard to the shoulder injury, Dr. McBride says there was not proper positioning and proper padding.
Could I get you back to the necessary surgery? Where in the report does the expert explain the damages resulting from the alleged unnecessary surgery?
Well, at the
end, would it be the rotator cuff?
I'm sorry?
Would it be the rotator cuff damage?
No, in fact, he talks about the damages that result from a surgery that would not have gone forward. It's at the very end.
Talking about the hospitalization, pain associated with recovery, et cetera, et cetera.
Right, ongoing pain, hospitalization, impairment, recovery, another surgery that was required to remove the bone stimulator. It's listed in there at the end after his comment about proximate cause. With regard to,
in other words, the surgery might have actually helped a condition, but all of these damage allegations here look to me to be the types of things that even if it was a necessary surgery, somebody would suffer. So I guess I was looking for something like this unnecessary surgery, and it's the result is this person's spine is defective in some way or something like that, but you don't have that.
No, I mean, it's not that specific, but it does say this surgery would not have gone forward in this setting. And the appellant has argued that that's mere conclusions that are not permitted. Conclusory opinions are opinions that are not tied to the facts. The court cannot draw inferences and fill in gaps, but our experts can based on the facts. And that's recently been your holding in Diaz-Rowena v. Melton, as well as the Hudoba case.
I guess another way to put the question would be, if he didn't need surgery A, but he did need surgery B, and as a result of surgery B, all of these you're listing here of hospitalization, pain associated with recovery, would have occurred with the needed surgery, then how was he damaged with the unneeded surgery?
Well, certainly the torn rotator cuff. But also, I would argue that this surgery would not have gone forward. It wouldn't have gone forward, and that's Dr. McBride's opinion, based on the facts, that it wouldn't have cleared approval from the insurance company, because Dr. Raynell said he lied. I mean, that's what the insurance company needed before they give permission, and that's in Dr. McBride's report.
I understand. I'm just saying, but if there was a different surgery that was needed that, and it has all of these same characteristics that result from it, hospitalization, pain associated, I'm a little bit lost on what your damages are.
Whether or not a surgery was needed for the true condition of an annular tear is a defensive issue. Our issue is, was there negligence and did it cause this harm?
Okay, that's just a different question from your
It is a different question.
Okay.
It's similar to requiring the plaintiff to disprove all the hypotheses, which is not required. But we think that Dr. McBride makes a fair conclusion that this surgery would not have gone forward based on the dishonesty to the patient and to the insurance company.
So even if the patient's health or physical condition was improved by the unnecessary surgery, you're saying you could have a claim for unnecessary surgery, the damages being that he was hospitalized and that he had to go through the trauma of the surgery and so forth, even if he was improved by the surgery that...
Well, no, I mean, Dr. McBride does not say he was improved by the surgery.
In fact, he says
he had ongoing pain. So I don't think you can conclude from Dr. McBride's report that he got better.
Well, I guess I was asking a hypothetical question more than anything.
If in fact he got better, he still went through an unnecessary surgery, and that's our argument.
Okay, that's one.
I would like to move on to the issue of the fact that the appellant did not appeal the fraud and constructive fraud issues. So those are not before the court. That, I think, gives us one theory of liability that is established. We've met all the burdens, and that's not in question. In that setting, I would urge this court to take this opportunity on this case to hold that if you have crossed the threshold on one theory of liability, that the cause of action may go forward, and that you sort of try to close the floodgate on going through these expert reports and looking at every individual theory of liability. Because in doing so, theories of liability are being dismissed based on expert reports. And I don't think that's what it was intended by the legislature with Chapter 74.351. If we cross the threshold on just one theory of liability, we should be able to go forward with our lawsuit, conduct discovery, develop our theories, even if it's not in the expert report. For example, the case you just heard, if there was an argument about a delay in diagnosis of infection, let that theory go forward, and then you may get discovery about what to do with a proper sponge count. This case clearly has merit because they haven't appealed the fraud and constructive fraud issues. The defendant knows the conduct that's been called into question. This isn't a summary judgment hearing. This isn't a trial on the merits. And what's happened with all of these cases is that we're going down a road that every case that's filed, every expert report that's filed, is challenged. And it's challenged on these nitpicking details and individual theories. And I don't think that's the intent of the statute.
So are you suggesting that if you file suit and you allege multiple theories, common law theories, statutory, what have you, it sounds as if you're saying that you should be allowed to go forward on your medical negligence theory if you have, among these other theories, you have a theory that, you know, would pass a no evidence summary judgment muster or something like that. Is that what you're saying?
That is what I'm saying.
Even if you have no expert report or a deficient expert report, you should be allowed to go forward on your medical negligence theory?
It is basically what I'm saying. The statute refers to a claim. Dismiss a claim. This is in 74.351B1. You dismiss the claim if the report is not sufficient. Claim is defined as a cause of action in that particular provision. The cases, for instance, Farishta, which I know you're familiar with, addresses claim in another section of the statute where you're talking about claims of damages. And that has been extrapolated to the claim in the first provision. But I'm saying that if you have a claim that has a theory of liability that shows there's merit, and you've got an expert report that supports that theory of liability, then you have crossed the threshold. And at that point, the door should open for you to proceed with your lawsuit, your discovery, and your trial on the merits. The trial court has ample ways to deal with the individual theories of liability. If you don't have evidence, there's special exceptions, there's summary judgment, there's directed verdict. But all of that has been brought into an attack on an expert report and challenging it through this means rather than the traditional means that we've been afforded in the past, and that is my argument. Finally, if you decide the report is deficient, I would request that you remand this to the trial court for consideration of a 30-day extension that's certainly been allowed in by the Supreme Court. Also, if I may make reference to the Murphy v. Russell case that was argued, that case is a battery case, but no report was submitted. And the Supreme Court said in that case, and I think it's consistent with what I'm arguing, that you may have a theory that requires no expert evidence to succeed in the trial court. But even if it's a battery case, you still need this expert report on standard of care, breach, and causation. That's distinguishing that there are two different things. And if you've got the expert report that establishes those three things on one theory of liability, you should not be barred from the rest of your lawsuit because he doesn't consider every possible theory of recovery. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Birdwell.
If I may, Your Honor, I'd like to address the argument with regard to that she's made that essentially that all that's required by 351 is a threshold report of a single cause of action, and once you do that, then you are free throughout the remainder of the litigation to amend or come up with different theories of liability have absolutely nothing to do with the original theory, and that you do not have to in any way, shape, or form demonstrate the prima facie merits of that particular theory. Informed consent is actually a very good example of that, because in a single case you can have a claim that a cause of action, if you will, that the physician failed to disclose material risks inherent in the particular procedure. That would be an informed consent case that has distinct elements of that particular cause of action as to what constitutes a material risk, whether it was inherent in the procedure, and the causation is different as well. You would have to demonstrate that a reasonable patient, given that information, would not have consented to the procedure. That's different from what is a battery case, in which case the allegation is that a poor success rate with regard to a particular procedure was not disclosed, or the fact that a resident would be performing the procedure as opposed to the surgeon, him or herself, was not disclosed, and therefore an allegation that had that information been provided, consent would have been withheld. That would be a medical battery type of cause of action, and that would be distinct elements as well. And then there could be also a claim that in performing the procedure was performed improperly, there could be various and sundry aspects of that. You could have had that in this particular procedure, that the wrong level of the spine was operated on, and as a result of the positioning, a rotator cuff was torn. And so there are distinct causes of action that the definition of healthcare liability claim clearly contemplates, because as the court recalls, it says specifically that it's a claim, whether the claim or cause of action sounds in tort or contract. Well, tort and contract are different theories of liability, and So as you did in the Murphy case, you had a breach of contract alleged as well as a battery alleged, a tort and a contract. And according to the Supreme Court, an expert report was required for each of those, as well as the DTPA claims. If you are to hold as you have been requested and urged to hold, you are then setting up a situation where the expert merely says, well, this particular aspect of the procedure was improper, and therefore I've met a threshold requirement, and I don't have to prove that a material risk of the procedure was not provided. I don't have to prove that or say anything about the fact that a resident performed the procedure and that was not disclosed. I don't have to prove that an aspect of the contract, that there was a contract to cure here. I don't have to do any of those things. And that clearly was not contemplated by the legislature. Where I think counsel may have a better argument would be if you were dealing solely with the performance of a procedure, and there are aspects of whether or not during the course of that procedure, for example, a proper monitoring of the blood loss during the course of the procedure, where the incision occurred, whether...
Counsel, let me just... What you're saying is essentially that as to each and every health care liability claim, that there must be an expert report as to each of those claims for those claims to go forward. But as to anything that's outside a health care liability claim, you're not suggesting that the plaintiff couldn't go forward on those, even though it may involve a health care provider.
Well, there have been cases that where the courts have found that there has been a premises liability theory,
right?
For example, that it didn't have to do in any way, shape, or form with health care, and therefore it wasn't a health care liability claim.
So the question is it a health care liability claim? And if so, your position is then there must be an expert report that meets the requirements of the statute for the plaintiff to be able to go forward on that particular claim?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
And there is a question here whether or not the fraud and constructive fraud claims are, in fact, health care liability claims. I'm not aware of a case that has so held yet.
Your time's up, counsel.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
That's all right. You answered my question, though. I appreciate it very much. Thank you, Ms. Wolf, Mr. Birdwell, co-counsel. The case is submitted, and we'll ask the clerk to adjourn us for the day. Thank you.